Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I'm Matt.
And today we are discussing losing everything to financial empowerment with Tiffany Alice.
Yeah, Joel. Tiffany Alice is also known as the Budgetnista, and her mission is to make life-changing financial education accessible to women worldwide. She's the author of the best-selling book, The 1 Week Budget, and she's been featured on MSNBC, The Today Show, Forbes, and earlier this year, she was instrumental in a new law that passed in New Jersey that will have a massive impact on financial education there in her home state. So, Tiffany, thanks so much for joining us today on the show.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm so excited to ask you about that law. But real quick, Tiffany, every week on the show, Matt and I drink a beer. And it's kind of this reflection of the fact that we choose something intentionally to splurge on, even while we're saving wisely for the future. And today on the show, we're drinking Mountain Beer Kolsch by Telluride Brewing Company. Our friend Alex at the brewery sent us this beer. I wanted to ask you, though, what is something that you intentionally splurge on now? You spend a lot of money on, even though you're being wise and saving intentionally for the future?
So if you would have asked me maybe a couple years ago, I would say vacations. But honestly, and honestly, then I was a smart vacationer in that, like, I was Grouponing a lot. So my husband and I purchased a house about a year ago. We renovated it. And I told myself I wasn't going to go crazy with decorating, but I'm not going to lie. Every single day that doorbell rings, I'm like, yes, more stuff. Because it's, I have to, you know, like, tablecloths and napkins and rugs. And he is like, who are you? And so I have not been budgeting the house, but I'm like, this is our almost forever home. And I'm just excited because we went from a 2-bedroom apartment and we saved up. We bought this house cash, so we don't have a mortgage. So I feel like we can get a little gangster when it comes to purchasing. Well, me anyway, purchasing the things to make the house cute.
I love it. Well, you and my mom would get along swimmingly, by the way. She could talk about home decorating with you for hours.
I love it.
So Tiffany, you know, we mentioned that law that you had worked so hard to get passed there in New Jersey, and it just went into effect. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it was a 3-year journey. A friend of mine, actually, she actually came to one of my classes. She wasn't my friend at the time, but her name is Angela V. McKnight. She was a member of one of my classes. I used to teach a lot of free classes in Newark, New Jersey via the United Way. And she came to one, and she does a lot of work in the community, and she became the assemblywoman in Jersey City. And so when she became the assemblywoman and everyone loved her, she was like, Tiffany, you're the first person I thought of. I want to bring education to the forefront in New Jersey, but specifically financial education. And I told her, well, there is a law in place for high school already, making it mandatory for high school students to get financial education, which is awesome. But I taught preschool for 10 years, and I used to teach the 3- and 4-year-olds about money. And I told her it should start before high school. So I helped to write a bill to just really get the languaging together of what did educators need to make this happen for. I wanted as low as elementary school. So we were able to get a bill together and accepted for middle school. And after 3 years of back and forth, it finally became a law in January. But now the kids are going back to school right now. So they will be the first kids, the middle school kids in the state of New Jersey, to see financial education intentionally and by law integrated into their classroom. So I'm super excited about it.
That's amazing. Like, first off, congrats to you on having the fortitude to kind of stick it out. And because that's a long process to try to get legislation passed to make a move like that. And but it's like going to have such payoff for those kids, right? And Matt and I, this is a topic we've talked about on the show before. It's something we care a lot about. And it's something that's missing from education for kids. And it's a thing, right, that they're going to have to deal with day in and day out for the rest of their lives that they didn't learn anything about unless their parents taught them about it, right?
And many parents don't know. So how do they teach what they don't know? And so that's what I wanted. And I remember there was some push because I was an educator for many years. And so I remember the pushback at first where, like, educators there are already so many rules. Like, you have to teach math this time of day. You have to teach literature this time of day. You have to teach history. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I remember the pushback. So I really made sure to craft the language that it was about integration, not interruption of the educational day. So it's not like, hey, stop, financial literacy time. Instead, if you're doing art with the kids, why not have them make their own piggy banks out of shoeboxes, right? Or if we're doing math, why can't they count money and have a school store? So you can integrate financial education versus like stopping the day and interrupting the day and trying to squeeze in financial education. So that's what makes this bill really exciting. I call it the Budgetista bill, but really it's bill A1414. So if anyone's interested in trying to bring this kind of legislation to their state, you can just Google like New Jersey A1414, look at the language and see if you can find your local assemblywoman and help craft that bill and be present so it can be hopefully pushed into law.
What better way to learn about money than when it feels applicable? You know, when you're learning about it in subjects that you're already currently learning about, it feels a little more real. And I'm sure that's going to stick with the kids a little bit more. So speaking of education, Tiffany, let's go to the beginning of you learning about money. So how did you first learn about handling your money well?
Well, I was fortunate in that I grew up in a household where money was talked about. My father, who's now retired, he was a CFO as well as an accountant. And I'm one of five girls. So, you know, all those girls, whoa, money, money, money. I know. I don't know how they did it at the time, you know, when you're a kid, you're like, whatever, it's just fun times because you're one of the kids, you know? And I didn't understand why my dad was so crazy. and now that I'm an adult, I'm like, how do you even financially support five kids? But he and my mom, they figured it out. But even better than that, he was very intentional about teaching us about money. To be all the way transparent, I think my dad, well, obviously I know he was trying for a boy, clearly. My mom after five was like, it's not happening. But I think because my parents were both born in Nigeria, and quite honestly, Nigerian culture is really very male dominated culture. So it's like, I have a boy, I give my boy everything and teach him everything, and he will take care of his sisters. Like, that's the thinking. But girl after girl after girl, I'm really grateful I didn't have a brother because he was forced to say, well, the things that I was going to kind of give to my son to look after his sisters, I'm going to have to give directly to my daughters. And that wouldn't have happened if I would have had a brother. So that's what he did. We would have weekly family meetings and we always talked about money. It could be something as simple as, you know, here is the electric bill from last month. Here's the electric bill this month. It went down, so I'm going to put the extra $50 that we saved into our vacation fund. Or, you know, you want to buy something and my dad would have you break down exactly what you wanted, how much it cost. Did I price check any other place? Is that really the best price? I mean, there was no lesson that he couldn't teach financial education with. Probably my earliest lesson, I had to be like five and I used to run the water. I would go to the bathroom, turn on the sink, and I loved the sound of running water. I think I was feng shui, right? Right? Can you imagine just all that wasted water? And I would have a heart attack. So do you guys have kids that are like 3, 4, 5?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's the zone that we're in right now.
I'm hearing you talk about that, and I'm thinking,
stressing out.
Yes.
That's my 3-year-old, and I have to constantly be like, turn that water off.
Yes. And it's very difficult. Like, there's really no reasoning with a 3-year-old. They just, you know, they are the boss of the house. You just have to admit it. And so that was me. And then, so what my dad figured out was, so when we were really young, we didn't have much money. So when the ice cream man came along, if it was your day, then you could go get a dollar. Everyone else had to get ice cream from the freezer. So because I'm second, my day was Tuesday. And so ice cream came along. I asked my sister, what day is it? Because, you know, I'm little. And she's like, it's your day. So I run in to get a dollar. My dad says, the water man just left. And I'm like, what does that have to do with anything? He said, you know how you run the water every day? And I said, yes. He said, well, it costs money. And I had to give your dollar to the water man. I had a heart attack. The water man, where is he? I want my dollar back. But guess what? He made ice cream related to his bill, his water bill. And so because of that, I never ran that water again. And he was really good at teaching lessons in that way where he made what was important to him also important to me, but in a way that I could understand at whatever age I was. And so that's the household I grew up in. And I was fortunate in that. And then I kind of took that understanding and even just that way of teaching. And I took that with me as the Budgetista.
Tiffany, it's interesting hearing you talk about that. I want to know if those lessons that your dad taught, stuck with your siblings in the same way they stuck with you, because obviously they resonate with you to this day in this massive way. And siblings handle those lessons and those family meetings about money differently. Did any of your sisters kind of reject thinking about money well in hand because you talked about it too much growing up? Or how? Yeah, what did that look like in their lives?
Honestly, like the oldest is better than me. I mean, you would never, like her husband is a doctor. She's a scientist. You would never know. They live so frugally. I mean, they are really good with their money. So I'm trying to get to her level of budgetistaism. And the rest of the sisters, I would say the baby Lisa, oh, Lisa, she's probably the only one that we're like, Lisa, who are you? She, yeah. You know, to be honest, it wasn't because of my dad, because we're all 2 years apart. And then Lisa came later. She was the last ditch effort to have the boy. So Lisa came later. So it was like a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a newborn. Can you imagine, in one house? But then Lisa came 4 years after the fourth, because I'm 9 years older than her. So we kind of raised Lisa, and we raised her poorly. So because we were the oldest sisters, and whatever she needed, we got it for her. So my dad, you know, the way we were brought up really frugally, Lisa didn't experience that, because we really took care of her and got her anything she wanted. She was the baby. She was everyone's baby. So she's not the worst, but she's certainly not as frugal as the rest of us.
Tiffany, let's talk about credit cards as well. You mentioned how your dad helped you to understand credit cards from an early age. What were his tactics?
Well, I didn't really understand credit cards until I went to college. So my dad, like I said, was very practical. I was going away to school. He said, you're going to go to school. You're going to see all these credit card people. You are allowed to get one credit card. Here's the criteria. No annual fee. I said, okay. Ask about the interest rate. I don't remember what it was at that time. I think he kind of gave me kind of like a limit, like of what the interest rate, you know, whatever interest rate they were offering me, and no more than one card, and that he would pay the bill as long as the charges were for school. So for books and stuff like that. So I said, okay, I applied for a card. It came to my parents' house. And, you know, when I came home, we went over proper credit card usage again of like, you can use it. The best way to use a credit card is pay it off in full every month. Because you're a student, that's your job. My job as your dad, I will pay off this credit card bill every month, but it has to be school things. I said, okay. Went away to school, took the card. I was like, what's a little McDonald's between friends, you know? And so whenever I would come home, I remember the first time I came home, because my dad paid off my credit card bill every month, like he said, I came home to a highlighted credit card bill of all what he felt were non-related school charges.
McDonald's doesn't count.
If there was a bill on the table of you owe me $65 and like 30 cents, I couldn't believe it. I was like, what? He was like, yeah, you haven't been home in a while, but I see you were just over there swiping your card, enjoying your life. But I told you school expenses, these are not school expenses. So you have to pay me back. I paid off your card, but you need to pay me back these expenses. I couldn't believe it, but it was such a great lesson in that all of the choices you make, you have to answer for them. And I should have learned that lesson in high school, because I remember I started working when I was 14. I got my working papers. You would go to the high school, get your working papers, and you could work a little summer job. And I did that. And back then, you used to get something called a passbook. I don't know how old you guys are, but back then it looked like a passport. But you would actually physically go to the bank. Whenever you withdrew money or deposited money, they were basically, it's like going to a country. They would put like a stamp basically on your passbook. And so when I got my first little job, you know, paying me $200 or whatever it was, every time we got a paycheck, a week later, we would have to sit with my dad, bring your passbook, and explain all of your withdrawals and deposits and explain where your money went. So the first time I didn't really believe we had to do it. I'm like, well, it's my money. I can use it how I like. And he was like, no, you have to tell me exactly how did you use your money. If you couldn't remember, you had to bring receipts. And I can remember being like, oh my gosh, like begging my sister Tracy, let me borrow your receipts. She's like, well, what am I going to use? I'm like, I don't know. But what he was really teaching me, and at the time I thought, oh my gosh, my dad's so controlling. It's my money. I earned it. But I realized what he was doing is he was forcing me to be accountable for the choices I made with my money. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he knew I was not going to be accountable to myself, because I'm like, what? I'm 15. I don't care. I just like, you know, literally I used to spend almost all my money on like candy bars. And so, but he knew that like I was going to be accountable to myself, but that I would think twice about spending because I knew I was going to have to sit with him and explain where the money went. Those are the kind of things that I think I cannot overstate just how important those things were, because it wasn't, my dad didn't really lecture us about money. You lived the lesson. Like, you're 16 now, you can open a bank account, but only with a parental guidance. We're going to walk to the bank. There was a bank up the street from our house. We're going to walk to the bank and we're going to open a bank account together. And on the walk home, I'm going to explain to you how a bank account works. So we lived those lessons. Even now, my dad is in his 70s and I come to the house. He always asks, how's business going? How was your profit and loss last month? Not as good as the month before. How's revenue? You know, like, bring me your taxes. Like, I'm like, well, I've got a good accountant. He's like, not better than me. Let me see them.
Man, I love that about your dad. I love that he's so intentional. And being a dad of multiple children, I know that it gets harder the more kids you have to be that intentional. So, like, what a cool dude. Seriously, with a full-time job, raising five girls. That's huge. Like, that's really impressive. You tell this really amazing story about getting a bike, asking for a bike at age 11. Matt and I, we talk about biking on the show a lot, maybe too much. We love to bike. So tell us that story, because that involves your dad too.
Yeah. So I think I was 10 going on 11. And for my birthday, I really wanted a bike, because, I mean, you know, if you have kids. So because my sister, when she was 11, she got a bike. Kids keep score like nobody else. They don't remember ABCs, not 1, 2, 3s. But I remembered when Karen was 11, she got a bike. So that means I get a bike. And so I told him, he was doing the bills. I didn't know. But at the dining room table, and my mom is giving me the not right now look, because she knew I was asking for something. And I'm like, I don't know what that look means. I want a bike. And now I understand, like, paying bills is not a great time to ask for something. But I know he was doing the bills, because he always had like this accountant's calculator with the paper coming out of the back, which I loved.
Nice.
And I said, you know, daddy, and he was like, yes. I was like, well, you know, my birthday's coming up and I would really love a bike for my birthday. He said, oh. So my parents, like I said, are immigrants, and they come from Nigeria. And I swear my dad sounds like he just left. I'm like, still, the accent is super thick. If you have parents from other countries, for those listening, you know the history, like, of, like, your parents never lose their accent. So he said, oh, so you want a bike? He called me by my African name, which is never a good sign. Odochi, which is my African name. You want a bike? I was like, uh-oh. You've asked me that question twice. It doesn't sound good for me.
Bad sign. I think I'm getting a bike now.
Yeah. And he said, well, if you want a bike, you have to help me pay some bills. And I was like, oh, no. I have to get a job and pay bills? I'm only 10. You know, but what he meant was that he was doing, since he was adding up the bills, he said, you can use my calculator, which normally we weren't allowed to touch, and I can add up the family's bills. He had it on a yellow ledger pad, which he still does the bills like that to this day. It was like line item by line item. And I'm asking questions like, well, what's a mortgage? And he was like, that's how we pay for the house. And up until then, I thought you paid for the house like you bought a shirt one time, you know? Mm-hmm. And he was like, no, that we pay for the house every single month. And I was like, wow. And so I started feeling like a little disheartened, because I thought, oh my gosh, I see what's happening here. He's showing me everything else his money has to go to. Bike doesn't look good. And he said, well, here is how much your mom and I make a month, which kids don't have a point of reference, so I couldn't tell you what it was then. And this is what we're spending on bills. You've added up for me. Now subtract what we spend from what we make. And I thought, okay, there's still something left over. And he said, well, only some of the money that's left over can go to your bike, because we have to save some. And plus your other sister, Tracy, her birthday's in October. You've got two sisters' birthdays in November. And then Carol's is in December. And I was like, well, that's a lot of sisters. I'm just focused on me and my bike right now. But what I learned then is, at that time, I really wanted a bike that was like this really cute Barbie bike that was just my size. And for the first time, I thought about the power of purchasing and money, because I thought to myself, well, if I get a bike that's just my size, now that I see the process of what it takes to get there, if I get a bike that's just my size, I'm going to grow out of it. And then next year for my birthday, I'm going to have to ask for another bike. But I remember Karen, my older sister, got a camera when she was 12, and I'm going to want a camera for my 12th birthday. I don't want to get another bike. So let me, instead of getting this Barbie bike that I really wanted, let me get this bigger bike from Sears. My dad gave me a choice between this Barbie bike or this bike from Sears. And the bike from Sears was not cute. It was blue, it was big, and it was ugly. But I chose the Sears bike. I chose, because he's like, you know, the choice is yours. I'm not going to decide for you, but I chose the Sears bike. And if I ask to this day, my dad is something else. If I ask him to this day, how much was that bike? He remembers. And I can't remember what it was, but he remembers like to the penny.
Wow. He's got it on that yellow ledger pad.
And so, but what that lesson taught me, because I rode that bike through middle school when I got it. I rode that bike through high school. I used to play tennis, and I was a tennis team. I'm captain. Rode that bike to practice. I rode that bike during college break when, you know, you gain like the freshman 15. I rode that bike to lose weight. My dad, up until probably just a few years ago, he rode that bike for exercise, because now that he's in his 70s, we're like, Daddy, you cannot ride this bike. And so I got that bike when I was 11, and I'm 39 now. So 28 years later, that's a financial choice that I made that is still relevant 28 years later. And it's such a testament to, it's not just a blue bike. It's not just a haircut. It's not just another purse. It's not just a eating out. Everything you do with your money matters. What is your blue bike? Everyone has something that they're choosing that seems like not a big deal, but it's following them into the future. And is it going to be a good follow, or is it going to be a follow that's holding you back?
Tiffany, that's a great story about the bike. And the title of this episode is Losing Everything to Financial Empowerment. We kind of learned a little bit about why you care so much about financial empowerment, but we haven't really tackled the losing everything part. And we're going to get into that part of your story right after the break. All right, Jill, we are back, and we're going to talk more here with Tiffany, and we're going to launch now into some of the years after Tiffany left the house when she was out on her own. Tiffany, you were able to save around $50,000 in a couple years on a $40,000 teacher's salary. Can you tell us how you did that?
Yeah, so basically $40,000, I was making $39,000 a year. Like most things, it started before me leaving the house, meaning I had to make the decision beforehand, before I needed the money. And so what I did was, right after college, I had to make a decision. Do I want to move out? Which, who doesn't want to move out? Or do I want to stay home? I chose to stay home for a year because my parents, thankfully, were like, you don't have to pay rent if you're staying home and you're saving and you're working, which I did. So because of that, I was able to save. I was making, I think, like $14 an hour or something like that. And I think I was making maybe like $1,100, $1,200 a month. And I saved $900 of that, $450 every pay period. And I was able to save $10,500 the year I lived home. And so I told my dad I wanted a car. And he said, okay, well, buying a new car is a total waste of money because of depreciation. Unless there's some rare circumstances where it makes sense. But typically, buying a brand new car, it just doesn't make sense. So he said, I'm going to take you to the auction. And that's where I've got my car. And I remember thinking, really? Because my dad had a nice car. It was a Mercedes. And I'm like, you got this from the auction? He's like, yes. And so he said, you know, you have money saved and let's go. So I went to the auction. I got myself, like, I think it was a two-year-old Nissan Altima for $5,500. I said, great. And then I bought my furniture. I proceeded to go from furniture place to furniture place and negotiate to get the furniture I wanted for my upcoming apartment. My sister, who was still home at the time, was like, oh, if you move out, can I move out with you? I was like, sure, even better, a roommate. So I was making all of these pre-choices. And so as I was making these choices, so now I move out. Instead of paying $1,100 in rent, my rent is $550 because I'm splitting it with my sister. Instead of paying a car note, I don't have one because I paid for my car in cash. My car insurance was $62 a month if I had like just liability because I owned the car. So my life didn't cost me much. My life cost me, you know, maybe like $600-$700 a month. And by then I'd gotten a new job. And that was a job paying me $39,000 a year. So basically every other paycheck I could bank, because I had made these choices before I moved out, before I needed to. And so my life was really inexpensive. And so I was able to save, you know, about $40,000 in 2 years and some change. And my landlord, the lady, she wanted to go up in rent. And I thought to myself, well, maybe I'll just buy a house, you know, well, a condo, because I didn't feel like I was ready for a house. And I was like, my sister said she'd move in with me. I'm like, great, I'll charge you $100 less than what the landlady is charging me here, so she could help with the mortgage. And so that's what I did. I put a down payment on a condo. I didn't put all of it. I think I have an FHA loan, so I probably put down 3%. The condo was $220. That's what I bought it for. 2-bedroom, 1-bathroom. And my mortgage was $1,660, and my sister paid like $450 or something of that. So I was really proud of myself, but that's how I was able to do so. I made the choice to not add additional bills. Like, I didn't have a couch bill. meaning I didn't finance that. I didn't have a table bill, you know? That's the thing, you know, you graduate and then all of a sudden you have so many people have so many, because you're financing everything, you have a bedroom set bill. And honestly, to this day, I've never had a brand new car. The car I'm driving now, same thing. This is my third car that I paid for in cash. It was the car I bought now is a certified pre-owned. So I'm even smarter now when it comes to the car, because I get a car that's just a couple years old and with a warranty as if it's new. So there's ways to find discounts in your life. So I don't live less of a life, you know, instead I figure out what is it that you want and how do you get it at a discount?
Yeah. And I feel like there are so many ads for easy financing for pretty much everything. I mean, any retailer you go to, it's like, hey, do you want to pay 0% on this for the next 5 years? And people are like, oh, sure, that sounds great. But then what happens at the end of that 5 years when you're not ready to pay it off, the interest hits and boom, you're in a bad situation.
Yeah.
By the way, Tiffany, during the Great Recession, your school closed. You were a teacher. You were living really well on that $40,000 salary, saving a good bit of your money. But tell us how that affected you, the recession, and then the closing of the school you were working at.
It was life-changing. It's the reason why I'm the Budgetista 3 days before the new school year. So around this time now, because in New Jersey, the school opens in September. 3 days before the new school year, we get the call, like, the funding that we normally get for the school is no longer and don't come back. And it was doubly devastating because many teachers during the summer, they don't work during the summer. So typically one or two things happen. You either save your money in your own bank account, or sometimes the school will actually withhold some of your money during the year and then pay you during the summer. But for me, for the way my school worked, it was a small school. You saved your money during the school year and then you just lived off that during the summer. And so that's what I did. So imagine the summer's over. I'm basically tapped out, like, whew. I had like savings in general, just like from me just being a good saver. But as far as like my living expenses savings, I didn't have that. And then to get that call, and I was like, okay, so I wasn't fully freaked out at first. Cause I was like, well, Tiffany, you do have some savings, but when you have no income coming in, and right before the recession hit, I was a victim of a credit card scam that left me $35,000 in debt. A friend of mine, air quotes friend, I thought he was wealthy. This is back when you're young enough to believe. I was in my 20s. So I thought, like, because he had like a nice car and like this like penthouse apartment in New York. And I remember thinking like, oh, he's my wealthy friend. I wonder if he could teach me how to invest. So he convinced me to open up like two other credit cards and to pull off money as a cash advance, which is like the worst thing you can do. But I didn't know. And I decided not to tell my dad because I totally wanted to surprise him with my good choices. And so I pulled the money off and he was like, we're going to invest it and you're going to make, what did he tell me? I was supposed to make $2,000 a week. I mean, how crazy does that sound?
A little too good to be true.
Yes. And I did not ask the one person that would be like, are you crazy? This is a lie. So I pulled the money off the credit card. I remember I was sitting in the bank lobby waiting. They must have had me there for an hour because they thought that I was like being kidnapped. They're like, are you sure you would pull this money off? Is someone pressuring you? I was like, no. So I pulled the money, you know, off, gave it to him, was like, okay, tell me the next step about investing. And he promptly disappeared. It took me a few weeks to realize that he disappeared because we were still talking on the phone. And I'm like, he's like, oh, I'm investing your money. It's growing. Your first payment's going to be next month. And I was so excited that I decided that, you know what, for the first time, you know what, I can have a balance on my credit card because I'm totally going to be rich in a minute. And so I bought this online course for, I wish I would at least had stuff. I bought this online course to teach me how to start a business for $15,000. Can you imagine? I just don't even know what I was thinking. And so here I was, like, his was 15 or 10,000 or 15,000, whatever it was that I took out as a cash advance. But then I added 15,000 to that to learn from, like, it was like some financial guru. I won't even say his name because he's still out there. Some financial guru had like one of these like courses and learn how to, you know, start a business and all this other stuff. And so I said, oh, I'll do that. I totally want to learn. And, you know, I don't want to go back to the classroom. And so I spent $15,000 on this course that it wasn't the worst, but I definitely wasn't ready for it. And it wasn't worth that.
Yeah. And then those difficult situations kind of reared their ugly head without having the job. And then this credit card scam, you ended up losing your condo, didn't you?
Yes. So I had student loans for the first time because I just got my master's. So I'm like $50,000 in debt for that. Then the credit card scam happened, $35,000 in debt. And I already had this condo And then now I have no job. So even though I did have savings, I had about 2 years worth of like expenses saved. So even though I had savings, I had these two new bills, student loans and credit card debt on top of the mortgage. And it was devastating because I realized for the first time I had made a huge financial mistake, and not just one, multiple. So it didn't, I didn't even know how to process it. So honestly, for the first year and a half, I didn't do anything. I was just paying the minimum because I had my identity was linked to Tiffany makes good choices with money. And I realized that's not true. That's not true. That it was really just Tiffany listens to her father. So I had not internalized the choices. And so it forced me, and I didn't even tell him. I just moved back home. I remember just like bringing a lamp, then like a bed sheet, and then my bed. I was like, I'm back. And so I just moved. I moved back home. I was 29 going on 30. I spent my 30th birthday in my middle school bed thinking like, wow, life has a way of humbling you. And it took me a minute to get out of the funk because I had to forgive myself. Because I was like beating myself up. Like, how could you be so foolish, Tiffany? What's wrong with you? Like all of these things you tell yourself, which are just terrible things that you wouldn't say to a friend. So why would you say that to yourself? But you say those things and then you feel the sense of shame. And so finally, it really was a friend of mine who called me, and I kind of just like told her everything. And I was just so embarrassed. And she was like, Tiffany, welcome to everyone else's life. You literally are the only person I know that has not made a financial mistake up until now. Like, she's like, the rest of us have been broke. I hear you that you have credit card debt. Okay. Oh, you got student loan debt? Everyone has student loan debt. Like, you're losing your house. You know, honestly, almost everyone, that's what's happening around. And so what she made me realize is that I wasn't alone, and it allowed me to forgive myself. And in forgiving myself, I could see the solutions that I'd learned from my father. So I went back to the basics. I had less money at 33 than I did when I was 16. Like, that was humbling. I remember looking at my bank account. I was like, wow, you babysat and worked at the library when you were 16. You had a few thousand dollars in your bank account. You don't have that now. You have less money at 33 than you do at 16, Tiffany. And wow. I just remember thinking like, I didn't want that to be the end of my story. So as I was working through and helping myself, people started asking me for help. And because they saw that at least I was making a little bit of headway, and that's how the Budget Nista was born. I did a lot of volunteer work all 2009. I must have spoken in everyone's basement, everyone's church, everyone's Boys and Girls Club meeting. I spoke two or three times a week for free all 2019. And that turned into the Budget Nista 2010 when I got my first contract with United Way. I had volunteered with them, and then they were looking for a financial education teacher. They had just gotten some money from a bank, and they said, well, we'll pay you to basically do what you've been doing, teaching to the community. And that's when things started to turn around.
Tiffany, that's fantastic. It's amazing to see sort of your journey, right? Where you were, you know, riding along high, you know, you had that fantastic credit score, kind of ended up in the dumps a little bit, but then you kind of came out the other side and you just started there talking about Budget Nista. We're going to get more into your story as a teacher of personal finance right after the break.
All right, we're back from the break, and we're talking with Tiffany, the Budget Nista. And Tiffany, you just kind of started to touch on turning into the Budget Nista, which is like kind of this, in my mind, you're this superhero teaching people how to budget, right? And it's really cool. And obviously, you had these great lessons from your dad, but then you had this amazingly difficult time. And I feel like people that go through something difficult like that often have the most to teach because they've struggled. So tell us kind of what this transition looked like from starting to teach and becoming the Budget Nista. How did you evolve into starting to teach personal finance to others?
Because I had been a teacher for 10 years, that's how long I taught in the classroom. And like you guys said, you have little ones. There's nothing harder to teach than a 3 and 4 year old because they have no point of reference. You could be like, oh, this is red like an apple. What's an apple? You're like, oh boy, we have to start from the beginning. So I didn't realize that when I was teaching, I was really getting the best public speaking lesson and teaching lessons that I could ever receive. And so, because if you could teach, you know, children that young, you could teach an adult anything, you know? So as I'm someone who once I know a thing, like I really understand and know it, I'm able to then translate that into knowledge for others. And so I just lean on the way I teach preschool, the way I taught preschool is the way I teach financial education. you know, preschool teachers teach from a place of love, of understanding, of meeting you where you are, of empathy. And so I think that's kind of like what sets the Budgetnista apart. It started with me helping like friends. They would come over on the weekends to my house and I would work with them on their budget. And they would say, well, can I bring another friend next weekend? And then finally, a friend of mine was like, you should charge folks that you don't know at least. And so I started to do that. And then I reached a threshold because many of the people that I wanted to charge, they just didn't have it. And so I thought, well, is there a way that I can continue to teach folks where I don't have to charge them individually? And through my volunteer work, like I said, that's how the United Way came about. You know, I met with them, and the young woman who is now the executive director, she was a community developer at the time. And I actually helped her with her budget. And she was like, this is so great. Can you do this for my staff? I said, sure. And then that worked out. And she was like, well, can you do this for the city through the United Way? I said, sure. And that was such a lifeline. I did that for about 3 years. And it's the thing that held me over. And so because I knew how to write curriculum, I'd written the curriculum that I taught via the United Way. It was a 6-week course. And I would use social media. This is when social media was, it was really just Facebook. And people were just using Facebook personally, but I started to use my personal page just to showcase what I was doing. And people around the country started saying, hey, I'd like to come to a class. And I would be like, well, it's in Newark, New Jersey. Can you come to Florida or can you come to Oklahoma? And I'm like, no, not to teach a free class. And so I thought, well, what if I took this class that I teach at the United Way that I've already written, it's been vetted for 3 years and you've perfected it. What if I took it online? And so I did, and I created something called the Live Richer Challenge. And when I did that, I made it 5 weeks, the first one, and it launched 5 years ago. And my goal was to get 10,000 women signed up. It took me a whole year. I didn't know anything about paid marketing or anything. So it took me a whole year to get 10,000 women signed up organically. And we did the challenge together, hand in hand. I taught them how to budget, how to save, how to get out of debt, how to fix their credit, even how to start to adjust their insurance and beginning investing. And it went so well, they were like, can we do it again next year? And I said, well, why don't we do a different one? So I did a survey, and the survey came out that people wanted to learn how to save. So I did the Live Richer Challenge Saving Edition. And then the next year I did the Credit Edition, and then the Net Worth Edition, then the Home Buying Edition. And it went from 10,000 to 30 to now it's 800,000 women that have done one or more of the challenges.
That's amazing.
Thank you. So people ask all the time, like, how did you grow your audience? It was through those free challenges.
Well, I mean, speaking of free, like, it's just amazing too that you got your entire start from volunteering, right? Like, I don't want to overlook that. The fact that you were doing something that wasn't paying you money. You're doing something that you knew, you felt deep down that teaching, like, that's something that I should be doing. But from that, and from that passion and that calling, that's how the Budgetnista was born, essentially, right?
Yes. It's hard because I get it. Like, I get it when I see people, they're like, oh, well, this is a business. I have to make money. I totally get it. But I truly believe in living a life of service. It's the reason why I became a school teacher. I mean, I went to school for business. That's what my bachelor's is in. But I just didn't feel called there. I felt like it didn't matter what I did in this corporate environment. And I wanted the work that I did to matter. And so to me, there is no more noble profession than teaching, because you get to transform someone's life. You know, you teach a 5-year-old how to tie their shoe. They tie their shoe now, but not just that, but they're going to teach their kid to tie their shoe and their kid. You will forever be embedded in their life through that one lesson, let alone you teach someone how to read. What about if you teach someone how to save? Ultimately, my mission is to provide access to those who have been left out of the financial conversation. I am a teacher. That's what I want my legacy to be, that you've left this place better than you found it, that you have helped to transform people's lives through education. I just happen to choose financial education right now, but maybe 10 years from now, it might be something else. But because before this, it was preschool education. But I know that with a shadow of a doubt that I was created and made to be a teacher.
Well, we can tell that you've got the energy and the heart of service. I mean, obviously, to be able to impact 800,000 people through your courses, that's amazing. Your focus is mainly on teaching women. So I wanted to know, in your opinion, how do the challenges of personal finance differ for women compared to men, in your opinion?
To me, the basics are the same. Budgeting is budgeting, saving is saving. But women tend to put themselves last. Not to say that men you know, don't think of others, but women especially. Women overcompensate, not overcompensate, over-sacrifice. Women over-accommodate. Men, they're taking care of their family, they're doing what they're supposed to do, but they're not overcompensating, which is a good thing. I feel like women sacrifice more than they need to or should. And so that's a lot of what I do, the work I do, is to make sure that women can release the guilt of doing something for themselves. Like, it is okay to do something for yourself. You know, it doesn't make you a bad mom, a bad sister, a bad cousin. You don't have to say yes to everyone. You don't have to take care of every single person. Your cousin can work too. You don't have to pay all her bills. It's okay to tell your kid, hey, you know, you can't stay with me until you're 45. But women, I find, have a hard time with that. And so that's, I do a lot of like money, mental money work with women.
Yeah. And so Tiffany, when it comes to investing, from all the stats that I've seen, it turns out that women tend to invest a little more conservatively, and that impacts them pretty negatively in their retirement. So is that something you also kind of help them figure out how to invest properly?
Well, more so the mindset part. Because I always say, tell people, I'm the budgetista, not the investinista. And to be honest, I'm one of those women. I am a hoarder of cash. Even now, I mean, I invest, but I'm scared. Part of the reason why, like, if you go to like any middle school and you see teachers asking questions, the boys' hands are going to shoot up. And they are only kind of sure that they know the answer. Girls are like, okay, I studied last night. I did the homework. You know, I read the book. I did everything. I'm not sure. Women don't like to act unless they're absolutely sure. You know, I feel like boys, I don't know whether it's nature versus nurture, really go for it and they figure it out later, which is such a great trait. And I feel like that's something we want to teach our girls. That, I don't know if you guys have girls, but...
Yep, lots of them.
And so you'll find, like, you know, sometimes it's not polite for girls to be bold, and it's not feminine for girls to like be first to answer, you know? And so girls are taught to be good. And I feel like boys are taught to be great, if you know what I mean. You know what I mean? Like, she's a good little girl. You know, you're quiet, you're sweet, you're kind, like, take up as little space as possible. That's girls. Be over accommodating, super sweet. And I just think that it runs into women being afraid to be assertive. I think there's a stat that shows something to the effect that women, like 70% or more women, don't negotiate when it comes to their salary. And we all know now that if you don't negotiate your salary and the next job you go to ask for what your salary was, you stunt your growth. So if your counterpart negotiates 50 and you get 35, then at the next job, he might get 70 and you'll get 50. And then before you, like, it's this like effect over time that you're going to make less over time as a result of like not standing up for yourself. So yeah, women are afraid to invest because quite honestly, they're unsure. So I think there needs to be more conversation spoken directly to women when it comes to investing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and as fathers of daughters, right? Like, I mean, I know Joel and I, one of our goals is certainly to raise our girls to be bold and to, you know, to go out there and to be great, right? I also love, too, that you mentioned how so much of what you teach and what's in your Live Richer Challenge is tackling that mindset of how you view and how you approach money. It just shows how important that is to just, it's not about knowing the right things to do and the tips and the tactics, right? But it's adjusting how it is that you frame your view of money altogether. And I think that's so great that you spend so much time on that. On that note, though, one of the actual tips and tactics, you know, we need to talk about your namesake. We need to talk about budgets. Full disclosure, Joel and I, we've talked about this before, but I tend to budget every cent. I'm very much a numbers guy, whereas Joel, he has more of a general idea of his spending. You know, we each have our own take on it. In your opinion, why are budgets such an important aspect of, you know, what you teach of the Live Richer Challenge?
Well, budgets are your financial foundation. It is the foundation that you're going to build the rest of your financial house on. And you can grow great wealth, but if there is not some sort of budget in place, then it's going to be very easy for that wealth to leave you. We've known of so many folks, you read, you watch on TV, people that won money through the lottery or athletes. But with a budget, you get to see that. A budget is a physical picture of what your money is doing. A budget tells you, your money is going here. your money is not going here. Your money is growing or isn't growing. A budget is just a clear understanding of what's happening. And if you don't like the picture with the budget, you can always change it. And so that's why I'm so passionate. If you start with the budget, then it helps to really answer a lot of those other questions that people typically ask.
Well, so for a lot of people, budget feels more like a four-letter word, mm-hmm. and they just completely avoid it like the plague. So let's say there. I know there are people out there listening that have never created a budget because it is just such a freaky thing to begin. So for people like that, what, in your opinion, what's the easiest way to kind of get started, to actually make it happen and kind of get over that fear?
So if you're someone like me, I forget who said, was it Matt or Joel who said you're the super numbers person? That's me. Like I'm
yeah, that's me as well.
Yeah. Right? I'm like, my penny went here. Where's my nickel? But if you're someone who is not like that, which typically most people are not, then even you can start with some kind of like pre-work until you actually physically write that, because you have to write down a budget. You have to physically see it, whether it's an Excel spreadsheet or whatever. But some pre-work is this. Open up, at the very least, almost everyone has a regular checking account. It's attached to your debit card. At the very least, start and open up a second checking account at that same bank and call it your bills account. And to start, just tell yourself, and you can actually go to your place of employment and ask if they allow you to split your paycheck. Most places will let you split a few times, but some, if it's a small company, will not. But if you're able, then you can start by kind of working the budget before you even do the math, before you do the hard math anyway. And you say like, okay, I know my bills cost me, say like, just for math's sake, $1,000 a month, and I make $2,000 a month. So that means every pay period, I'm going to have $500 of the money that I receive go into my bills account. What that'll do is will automatically separate your bill money from the rest of your money. So that's great, because what that means is you're not going to get a debit card with that checking account. They're going to ask you, you're going to say no, and then you're going to set up automatic transfers from that bank account. I like to transfer out. I don't like people to come in, because sometimes they take too much by mistake. So I like to transfer out, like pay my mortgage out, pay my car note out. I get to control on my end. And if you're worried that you might not always have the money, then you just set aside a day of the week, Saturday, every other Saturday, you're going to make transfers to pay your bills. So that's one. Then you should open up an online only savings account. I truly believe in saving your money in a place that makes it inconvenient. So your two checking accounts are at your brick and mortar regular bank for convenience, but your savings for the large part should be at an online only bank. And then what happens is you link your online only savings account to your checking account, the one with your debit card. Or you can even go to your job and say, I want you to split my check three ways. When my money comes in, I want some to come to my regular checking account. I want my $500 to go to my bills account. And I want whatever it is, $200, $100, whatever dollars, $50 to go into my savings account. If they won't split it, make the transfer yourself. And what's so great about an online-only bank is that, one, you're going to be paid out a higher interest rate, because a brick-and-mortar bank is right now, they're paying like 0.001%, like a piece of a penny. And online-only banks are now averaging about 2%, two and some change, so at least two pennies. So you're going to earn more money on your savings. And in order for you to get your money back to spend, you have to make a choice ahead of time, because you have to transfer from your online-only bank to your physical brick-and-mortar bank in order for you to have access to your money. And what's so great, because you're not going to open up a checking account at your online-only bank, and that's at minimum a 24-hour wait. So there's going to be no more impulse spending with your savings. You're going to be forced to save. So if you don't know how to budget at all, if you just do that to start, set aside bill money, set aside savings, automate those transfers, then it will at least lock you in, because what's going to be left in the checking account tied to your debit card is really going to be your spending money. So you can't spend your bill money. You don't have a debit card with that. You can't spend your savings. Your savings is locked away in this online-only bank. So what's left is what you're allowed to spend money with. And then once you get over kind of like that hump of like that budgeting, and that's like the loosest way to budget, then you can start really doing the math and just making a list of all of your expenses and what they cost you monthly. And that same thing I did when I was 11, wanting the bike, subtract it from my monthly take-home pay, and seeing like, where do you stand? And then making choices from there. But I don't look at my budget as a no. My budget is my say yes plan. And so if you look at it differently, it treats you differently. I say, hey, budget, I want to go on vacation. I've not been on vacation in a long time. I would really love to go to Italy, and I saw a Groupon for Italy for $800. So my budget, say yes, come on budget, come on. I look and I'm like, how can I save $800 in the next 6 months? Okay, 800 divided by six is, I'm not really good at math off the top of my head. What is that? 800, I'm doing it on my
calculator. I don't know, 120 bucks, something like that,
right?
A month?
Uh-huh, it's like 130, right? So $130. What can I do budget to save $130 a month specifically for vacation? Do you really need this cable, Tiffany? I mean, you have not watched TV in months because you're busy. Your cables cost you 200. It doesn't have to be forever. Okay, cutting the cable. So now I can save $200 a month, 6 months, go to Italy. And if I want to turn the cable back on, great. And if not, I can, you know, sign up for Netflix or Hulu or whatever. But do you see, you can get your budget to say yes. Like I said, I don't look at my budget as restrictive. My budget is there to accommodate me and to tell me yes, if I'm willing to make a different choice. So I don't feel like I'm saying no to cable. Instead, I'm saying yes to Italy. I'm not saying no to brunch. I'm saying yes to Paris. And so you have to decide what's your Italy, what's your Paris. There's no judgment on like what you want to say yes to, but it's okay to say no to things that are not that important to you so you can say yes to the things that you truly, truly desire.
Man, Tiffany, I completely agree. Like that's one of the ways that my wife and I were able to get on the same page when it came to budgeting as a newlywed couple, was identifying that this is money that we're agreeing to spend. We're just doing it ahead of time, and we're doing it proactively with intention. Just like you said, we're intentionally spending our money versus just letting our whims sort of dictate where our money goes. So I'm a big fan of that. And this has just been an awesome conversation, Tiffany. We really appreciate you sharing your story with us, kind of talking about all that you've got going on now with Budgetnista. For folks that want to learn more about you, you know, where could they find you?
I am the Budgetnista everywhere. I am the Budgetnista.com. I'm the Budgetnista on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook, YouTube, everywhere you can think of. And if you're just needing help, because like I said, for me, it's service first, people, purpose, then profit. And so if you're just needing help, if you go to thebudgetnista.com, well, you could really just go to liverichardchallenge.com. And that's where all those free challenges are. They're about a month long course. I walk you through step by step through whatever your challenges are. It is my goal that they're always free, that they'll never cost anything. It's just my gift to folks that are willing to do the work. All you have to do is know how to add, subtract, read, and write. And I give you all the other tools that you'll need. So I really, truly love helping folks. So I love to help you on your journey as well.
Thanks, Tiffany. This was such a fun conversation. We really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
All right, Matt. I really enjoyed that conversation with Tiffany. Man, what an energetic personality with just so much love for people and to see them do better with their money. I feel like there were a lot of great things we could take away from this conversation. But what was your big takeaway from it?
Yeah, man, for me, it's got to be money accountability. At the very beginning of her conversation with Tiffany, she talked about how her dad provided that accountability. He made her sit down. He made her look at all the money that she was saving, but spending as well. And to us, that's what budgets are for us today. It's a way for us to modify our behavior, to control our spending, so that at the end of the day, we not only know where our money is going, but that we're happy with where our money is going because we have intentionally decided where we're going to spend it. So yeah, we've got an interview with the Budgetnista. No surprise. For me, it's budgets.
Yeah, I think my big takeaway from this episode was long-term thinking when it comes to purchases. And Tiffany's story about choosing a bike really resonated with me. That makes a lot of sense. I try to do my best to put those shoes on every time I'm thinking through a purchase. How long am I going to actually use the item that I'm buying? Is this something that is only going to be useful for a short period of time? Like, let's say I'm going on a camping trip and I almost never go on camping trips. Would I decide to buy a new tent and buy a sleeping bag and all these things? Or would I find a way to try to borrow them or to try to maximize the value I can get out of something? And I think a lot of times we're really short-sighted in our purchases. And hearing the story about the bike just reminds me to be super thoughtful about the purchases I make and make sure that when I commit a decent bit of money to something, then it's going to be useful to me for quite a bit of time. So yeah, that was my big takeaway.
Nice, man. Let's kick it back to the beer. This episode, we had Telluride Mountain Beer, which is a Kolsch. And no surprise, it's brewed by Telluride Brewing Company. Joel, what were your thoughts on this beer?
Yeah, man, I don't drink Kolsches very often. So the flavors in a Kolsch are not something I experience very often. This was super clean. It was crisp. It was kind of refreshing. What they say about beers like this is that you can tell when something is off pretty easily. There aren't massive hops or adjuncts to be added to it that can kind of cover up a bad brewing process. And you can tell that this beer is just brewed really well. It's very clean. And I thought it was delicious, man. It kind of makes me want to start drinking a Kolsch every now and again. And by the way, listener Alex, who works for the brewery, sent this one our way. Big thanks to him. He calls himself the head fishing guide at the brewery, which I love. I love that that's his title.
Nice. Is that because he loves to fish?
He does. He does. We emailed back and forth a little bit, and yeah, he loves to fish.
Yeah. Thanks again, Alex. We really appreciate this. You know, Joel, I totally agree with you. We don't drink this style often. We're big fans of IPAs, but more often than not, man, we are gravitating towards this style. They're just so easy to drink. And I would say this is a perfect interview beer. It doesn't distract from the conversation, and it's something that we can enjoy nicely there in the background while we're having a great conversation with our new friend, Tiffany the Budgetnista.
Yep. Good times. All right, folks. So if you want the show notes for this episode, you can check those out on our website, howtomoney.com.
Yeah, Joel, that's right. So that's going to be it for this episode, man. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.